This is Leg Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Child abuse is far too prevalent in Wisconsin and across the country, but it's not always easy to spot the maltreatment. Ideally, that's where child abuse pediatricians come in to help. But what happens when they get it wrong? Reporter and novelist Stephanie Clifford wrote about the specialists in an article published by the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. The investigation focused on two families who were accused of abusing their young children. Both families lost custody of their children based on reports from child abuse pediatricians. Medical evidence later showed other reasons for what had been labeled as abuse. Clifford spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about how this specialty came to be and the benefits and pitfalls of it.
I was talking to a lawyer just about general kind of family law stuff, and she kept saying child abuse pediatricians. And finally I was like, I don't know what are you saying? Like child abuse pediatricians? And I started to look into it, and it turned out it's a specialty developed in about the last 10 years. They started certifying child abuse pediatricians, and they're pediatricians who are trained in recognizing child abuse, who know certain patterns of bruising or certain burn patterns that might fit child abuse. And they're installed at most of the major children's hospitals around the country to assess for abuse, because it's a very hard thing to assess for. Most people aren't going to say they're abusing a child. Most little children, at least, aren't going to tell a pediatrician they're abused. So that's the thinking behind having this specialty. Once I heard that there was this term, child abuse pediatricians, I started digging into, well, is this just a term that lawyers are using, or is it a real thing, like a real specialty? So I began looking at it, and I found it was a real specialty. It began getting certified in 2009, and there are hundreds of child abuse pediatricians nationwide now. And they're a pretty tight-knit group. They share a lot of research. They go to conferences together. I started looking at some of those conference topics. I was able to obtain some trainings from child abuse pediatrician training seminars. And what struck me about that is how, obviously, there were medical topics covered, but there were also very specific legal topics covered, like what a Frey hearing is, what a Daubert hearing is. And these are things that, like, you wouldn't learn until the second year of law school, really. But these child abuse pediatricians, because they work so closely with prosecutors or with child welfare workers and child welfare lawyers, and testifying in court is a key part of their job. They're thinking so much from a legalistic perspective from the start.
And so you also spoke with two families who had experiences with these child abuse pediatricians. Can you tell me a little bit about them and their story and how it plays into what you discovered about child abuse pediatricians?
Sure. So the first family is a Wisconsin family. They lived in Racine at the time. He worked at a foundry. She was a bank teller. His name is Jose Santiago. Her name is Glendalise Galarza. And they had a little baby named Elihu, who was a couple months old. It was sort of a normal day. Jose was going to sleep, and he noticed the baby didn't seem to be breathing. And he ran downstairs, splashed water on him. The baby wasn't responding. He was sort of seizing up. He calls 911. They rush the baby to the hospital. He's transferred to Children's in Milwaukee. And there, all of these pediatricians and doctors are surrounding Jose and Glendalise. And they learn later that one of them was a child abuse pediatrician and was not asking questions so that they could treat Elihu as a treating doctor, but so this doctor could find out, had somebody abused Elihu, and if so, who was this, and then pass that report on to Children's Protective Services in Wisconsin so they could pursue a case. A similar thing happened with the other family who was outside of Chicago. Their baby had a complicated medical history and had to go back into a hospital, and there they found that there were some unexplained fractures on the baby. And again, they thought they were talking to a treating doctor who was asking them about, you know, family history, what's your marriage like, was this baby planned? And the mom in that case, who's a dentist in suburban Illinois, was just telling this doctor everything, thinking the doctor was treating her baby. And as she said, every word we used ended up in court. everything was used in a child abuse case against them. And both families ultimately lost their children. And in the Santiago family, the baby died and Josue was charged with homicide in that death.
Why is it that child abuse pediatricians don't have to identify themselves, or do they?
They don't have to identify themselves as child abuse pediatricians, and often they do not, because it puts the parents on edge and they feel they can't get straight answers, which may be the case, but it also means that these parents are not getting any notice that their words could be used against them, in a family court case, and family court is where child welfare services file to take custody of children from their parents, and B, in a criminal case. So they're not considered state actors, basically. They're not considered like police or prosecutors, so they don't have to give Miranda warnings. In family court, there are very few protections for parents to begin with, so basically parents are just kind of at a huge disadvantage from the start in this situation. And yeah, I totally connect with, like, I have two little kids myself, the idea of like rushing your kid to the ER, which I've done, and having all of these people ask questions, and you try to give them as much information as possible and as many explanations as you can. Like in Josue Santiago's case, they were like, well, maybe it was his little sister who was, you know, playing with him this weekend. Maybe it was this, maybe it was that. And unfortunately, one thing that child abuse pediatricians look out for is a shifting explanation from the parents about the incident. So that may have kind of rung alarm bells in the child abuse pediatrician's mind about, like, maybe these people did hurt their child.
How long have child abuse pediatricians been around, and why was this specialty created?
There was a great doctor I spoke to named Eli Neuberger, who is like this fascinating guy. He lives in Massachusetts. And he sort of tells his career arc, sort of tells the history of child abuse pediatricians. So when he was a young doctor, he got this case. He was asked to review a case of a child who may be being hurt. And he said, sure, like, I'll check in with him over the weekend. And social work said, don't worry about it. Like, you can see him on Monday. By Monday, the child had been killed by his parents. He'd been plunged into scalding bathwater and died what the doctor knew would have been a pretty horrible death. And he was so upset at the idea that he didn't do anything to prevent this. So he went to the chief of his hospital in Boston and asked, what are we doing about child abuse? What are we doing about cases that we're referring to child welfare? And the head of the hospital said, we're really not doing anything. What should we be doing? And so he started to look around, and he learned that there were only a couple of hospitals at that point reviewing child welfare cases formally and making discharge plans. And so he modeled what the hospital in Boston was doing after that. It was a group of social workers, child welfare workers, pediatricians, all thinking about, okay, what's a safe plan for this child so that they can hopefully go home with the parents, but also so that the parents can get the help they need. So over the years, he became something of an expert on child abuse. A few other pediatricians became similar experts on child abuse. And by the late 90s, they were thinking about, well, should this become a specialty? Should this become something that we have an examination for? And Dr. Neuberger thought, no. He was concerned that it would make the child abuse pediatricians more sort of an arm of the law or an arm of prosecutions rather than more independent investigators into whether abuse had occurred. But he was outvoted. It became a specialty anyway. And by 2009, they were issuing exams and certifying pediatricians as these child abuse pediatricians.
Is there any review of what child abuse pediatricians say, or any kind of check on their specialty, their power, and things like that?
That's a great question, and I think that's one of the things that this investigation for the Marshall Project and the Atlantic gets into, is that there's not really a check on them. In part, the other doctors at the hospital don't want to make a call about child abuse, and it's tricky. The families are upset, obviously, and they don't want to spend their time testifying. They want to spend their time in the hospital treating patients. So they're generally more than happy to hand over the call on whether this or isn't abuse to a child abuse pediatrician. The problem from there is that the child abuse pediatrician has unchecked power. They can, and we saw in this case, the child abuse pediatrician was overruling other specialists. They were, in these cases, I should say, were overruling other specialists, were kind of doing some follow-up tests, but perhaps not all, were discounting things that other specialists suggested, were discounting certainly the family's explanations. And then once the child abuse pediatrician, who's this, you know, erudite doctor, hands the diagnosis of, yes, this is likely abuse, over to a child welfare worker, who you have to imagine is usually pretty young, has a 2 or 4 year college degree, but doesn't really have the authority to stand up to an eminent pediatrician, the child welfare worker isn't going to go against that either, even if she or he thinks, well, maybe, you know, maybe there's not abuse here. That's, you're safer as a child welfare worker saying, yes, there's abuse, let me separate the family, than you are saying, well, maybe let me challenge what this doctor says.
And in talking with child abuse pediatricians through your reporting, what did you learn and what raised even more questions for you?
I think they believe that they're just one part in this process. And technically, yes, they are, but in reality, they have so much more power than anybody else in the process that child welfare, police, prosecutors, all, I just found, were just repeating their words verbatim, even when there was virtually no way that any of those players really understood what they were saying. It was these incredibly technical, fine, you know, scattered foci of hyperattenuation. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that was like repeated over and over in a report in the Santiago case. And you would see it repeated by police, repeated by prosecutors, repeated by even, you know, the medical examiner. So basically whatever the child abuse pediatrician says goes. And there was this upsetting, I would say, police question and answer with Josue Santiago. This is, his baby's in the hospital. He knows at that point his baby is brain dead and has maybe a day or two left to live. And the police brought him and the baby's mom in for questioning at a police station separately. And they questioned each of them for 6 hours. And the police kept saying, Dr. Rabbit, who's the child abuse pediatrician at Children's Milwaukee, who declined to comment for the story, but they kept saying, Dr. Rabbit says this can happen one of two ways. Either it's like a really hard car crash or you hurt the baby. And they just kept saying, like, she says you hurt the baby. She says, and he says, no, I didn't. And in their minds, her report by then had become hard fact and was sort of incontrovertible. And you see this moment in the transcript of the Q&A where they leave, the investigator leaves the room, and Josue, whose first language is Spanish, he's from Puerto Rico, is praying in Spanish, and he's just like, oh my God, like, we didn't do this. Please, Father, please, like, we didn't do this. And it, you know, when I talked to him later, and he was saying, he was like, my baby is dying in the hospital, and I'm having to have this 6 hour interrogation over, like, did I do it? Just say you did it. It was just heartbreaking.
What are the benefits of this specialty and what are the drawbacks?
The benefits are that you have somebody on staff who specializes in this. So that if a child comes in with a strange bruise, a regular pediatrician won't say, like, oh yeah, it's just a bruise. Yeah, it does sound like she fell off the swing, when it's clear to a specialist that there's no way you could get a bruise like that from falling off a swing or another accident, that it would have to be somebody was hurting the child intentionally. And there are so many cases of child abuse in the U.S. It's a terrifying thing. And so many of the victims can't speak or won't speak. You know, they're under 3 or under 4 and either won't explain what happened to them or are not verbal at that point. So they catch a lot of cases that otherwise might not be caught. The danger is that, you know, they are trained to find child abuse, and therefore, I think at least in these cases and in some of the other cases I reviewed, they find child abuse where there are other explanations, and it happens more frequently. And some of the research I looked into shows that child abuse pediatricians overdiagnose abuse, particularly in low-income families, in non-white families, and that is problematic because those people, of course, often have the fewest protections in court and may not be able to afford lawyers to fight out the case or to get their children back.
So in your reporting, did you find or talk to anybody who had solutions to this overreporting of child abuse while also needing specialists who can identify abuse?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of solutions at play. So one is in play in Texas. Congress there, the state Congress, is considering requiring a second opinion on all child abuse diagnoses. And I think that would perhaps have the child abuse pediatricians proceed with more care. Another idea that a few of the older pediatricians that I spoke to floated was having much more rigorous review of, okay, so you said it was abuse. Is there any substantiation of that? Like if the child was returned to the family, as the child in the Illinois case was ultimately returned to the family, did further abuse occur? Did the child have a healthy childhood? So looking back and doing outcome studies on what happened, I think would be incredibly useful. But right now, it's one of the rare fields in medicine where there's not much review. There's not much analysis of where did we get it right? Where did we get it wrong? Where, you know, if you're doing a heart operation and something goes wrong, you're immediately delving into every bit of, well, what happened here and what factors can we change? Where in child abuse pediatrics, it's not, that's not really followed up on.
Stephanie Clifford is a novelist and reporter covering criminal justice and business. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Wired, Marie Claire, and other publications. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel.